I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. Welcome back to the show. As always, I love putting together conversations that can help you learn more about our economy, business, financial literacy, our state here in North Carolina. And I've got a friend of the program and a friend of mine that is locking back in with us again. John Clowney is the owner of Bull City Cider. They've got tap rooms and wholesale production located here in North Carolina. He's also a former candidate for mayor in the city of Lexington, and just a really overall knowledgeable guy. John, how are you, man? Thank you for locking in.
Doing well, Algernon. Thank you so much for having us, as always. We appreciate, always appreciate the time.
Well, man, there's so many things that we can talk about today, but you and I recently had a nice offline conversation where we talked about some of the pressure that's going on within the craft brewery industry and just, I think, with spirits in general. And I thought that was some really interesting information and insight that you shared with me. So I wanted to get you on the show so that my audience had an opportunity to learn from you as well and just get some behind the scenes insight on what's happening with our beverage community, right? Not only right here in North Carolina, but really all over the country. But before we get started, I don't want to assume, John, that everybody knows who you are and they run out and buy all your products and your beer and that kind of thing. So let's start there. How about give my audience just a little introduction on who John Clowney is, Bull City Cider, and sort of what you guys been up to the last decade?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Definitely appreciate that. And hopefully by the introduction, people will go out and buy all our products. That's what we're looking for, right? But yeah, my name is John Clowney. I'm one of the founders and the CEO of Bull City Cider Works. In my former career, I actually worked for a private equity real estate firm and actually started my career with Merrill Lynch up in New York City on Wall Street for a couple years before that. So definitely the path of my education was not in science or brewing or anything like that, but definitely business focused, finance focused. Which at the heart of running a small business, whether it's a brewery, winery, or anything else, you know, the business is what it is, right? You might have a great idea, but the fundamentals of getting that product to market, to managing people, finding retail locations, if that's what your business is, it's all the backbone of it is business and finance and accounting. So luckily, I have expertise in that much more so than we ever had in cider when we were starting the cider business. But then since then, you know, obviously you try to really dive into whatever your industry is and learn more. So I've been to several different classes with the Cider Institute of North America. We've sent several of our employees in the past and cider makers to a lot of the same training. So really just trying to make sure that we have the best crew, the best team to make the best possible beverages we can make. So I think we've always been a thought leader in terms of pushing the boundaries and explaining different ways that cider could be marketed and consumed, not just going through traditional means and methods where it was more of a wine drink and not going the super sugary sweet like a national macro brand. So we kind of fit in the space in between that, and that's kind of where we like to live with our cider. But yeah, we started the company 10 years ago. I formed it legally in 2013. And then we actually got open for operations in Durham, North Carolina in March of 2014. So we've been, you know, coming up on 11 years here of operations. We started our Lexington, North Carolina location in 2016. And that's now where we do 100% of our production and distribution. So any cider you find of ours, whether it's in Wilmington or the Outer Banks or in the mountains or in South Carolina, comes out of Lexington, North Carolina, which has obviously a very strong history in manufacturing and production. So we were really happy, you know, when we started that location, we were kind of part of the rebirth and renaissance of this depot district and this town that had been so heavily reliant on manufacturing and manufacturing activities. It really allowed us to come in and help revitalize the area that had otherwise been, you know, pretty vacant for a decade before we got there. Now, when you look at it, and I know you've been involved with several different folks who are meaningful to the Depot District, we've got apartments and condos under development now. We've got a brewery and restaurant across the street. You know, there's still some furniture distribution happening. We just had a great event venue and distillery open up in Rick House in Holland Brook. So you just did a showcase there this past weekend to show off Lexington a little bit. So a lot of great things are happening in the town, and we feel fortunate that we've been able to be a meaningful part of it and really help spearhead a lot of that transition and transformation of that area. So that's one aspect of what we've done, and certainly been very involved in the community since getting to Lexington 8 years ago. But then I know a lot of what we want to talk about today is, well, what was the other trajectory of our company? What else has been going on? So obviously, everybody in hospitality suffered the biggest dislocation in that market of all time with COVID and the pandemic, the shutdowns, the, limited occupancy, everything else that occurred with that. Well, during that time frame, we had a great 2019. We had our company moving really in the right direction and decided, look, we do a great job at retail tap rooms. They've got great margins on them. We've got plenty of capacity to make this. Let's continue our path forward and continue looking for what are our next locations? How are we going to grow our brand? And, we found a location in Greensboro that we opened up in January, February of 2021, coming out of the pandemic. So that's over in the Irving Park area off of State Street. We did sign a lease for a location in Cary, which is right downtown where there's a lot of revitalization and building going on in downtown Cary. If you went back a decade, decade and a half ago, there really was not a quote unquote downtown or heart for business and cultural social activities. Now Cary has Chatham Street, the Gussenhovens and several other developers have done a wonderful job of really building a community down there.
Let me jump in here, John,
Yeah, for
just
sure.
because I just so I can manage our time here. But nice, really nice overview of Bull City and some of the work that you guys have done up to this point. I think for some of my audience that may not be as familiar with cider, help us understand. I mean, in the craft beer space, what is the unique differentiator about cider versus some of the other beers?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously the primary difference is it's cider as opposed to beer. So your beer is going to be made with malt, with grain, right? So it's a gluten product. You're doing a mash, you're fermenting kind of the sugars that come out of that mash and making beer. So you start with wort, pitch in yeast, you get beer. But everything we do, it starts with fruit, right? And the primary fruit being apple. So apple is the first thing that we use. Whether that's juice, single strength juice, or concentrates, you bring it in, you're going to get your bricks where you want it, and then actually start the fermentation. So, much more of what we do is akin to winemaking. And if you actually look from a permitting level at both a federal and a state level, cider is considered unfortified wine, just like a Cabernet or Riesling or Pinot or something like that. So, it is fruit-based fermentation, and that is the primary difference. Along with that, there's a lot more cost that goes into the fermentation and the product because fruit is way more expensive than grain.
And I guess the $64,000 question that I'm sure everyone is wondering, how does it stack up in alcohol content? So if I'm drinking a regular beer versus drinking cider, how quickly am I going to get there?
Yep, exactly. So it varies because just like beer, you've got light beers that run 4.5%. You've got, imperial stouts that are running 10 or 12%, right? Cider could run the full gamut where you could have people that also make it more of a wine style, do some chapelization or sugar additions up front, do that fermentation and probably get it to a 10, 12, 14% alcohol and serve it more like wine. What we serve is about 5.5% alcohol by volume. So it's going to be more comparable to drinking your lager. Like I know, for example, you like a fat tire, it'd be around a fat tire, ABV, something like that. So, and we serve it in 12-ounce servings just like that as well. So it's a very much a comparable good or substitute good if somebody's not looking for gluten, not looking for beer. That's kind of where the cider fits. And that's really where it lives. If you look at it by the numbers, cider was, if you rewind back to 2012, 2014, I mean, the dollar volume of cider being sold and the production volume of cider was doubling every year for about 3 or 4 years. As that was occurring, you had a lot of macro companies, your big beer brands on a national level getting into the cider market, whether that was Johnny Appleseed or Smith and Forge, brands that had, all but disappeared at this point. So it really, there was a lot of growth in the market. However, a lot of the growth that was occurring was a very different product that had a lot of sugar to it. And I think it turned a lot of people off from the category overall. If you look at the category, it's less than 1% of overall alcohol volume in America. It's probably around a 450 to 500, $600 million total alcohol market of just cider, versus, craft beer is running about 7.2 billion. Overall alcohol sales in aggregate are probably, 250 billion or something like that, right?
So I guess for you, because when I think of cider, I think of like the Mike's Hard Lemonade or whatever. I mean, the kind of things that I probably would have drank before I actually started to really truly consume alcohol. So what does your customer look like? I mean, does it tend to skew a little bit older or a little bit younger? Is it like your first time drinker? Or what that person that's going in the grocery store buying Bull City cider, what do they look like to you?
Yeah, I think, historically, it would have skewed a little bit younger consumer because, like you said, it's maybe more approachable for some folks than like drinking an IPA, for example, which has a bitter profile and flavor to it. It's not. We have ciders that have cherry in them. We have blueberry and lemon ciders, things like this, that are a little bit different in the category. And so I think if you rewind and kind of as we were starting and really the category was growing, I think you were seeing a lot of interest probably by your younger 20 to 38, 21 to 30 age group bracket, as opposed to call it your 60-year-old male who's only consumed scotch and that's what he likes. That wasn't really our demographic. We weren't changing that person's appetite or mind share from it. But if you had somebody looking for potentially something that was gluten-free, potentially something that had a little less calories, then this is where I think you started seeing a lot of growth. I think historically, probably a 70-30 more female versus male consumption. But I do think that that has probably narrowed a little bit, since 10 years ago.
You and I are we talk a lot offline, so I know you're very familiar with our mutual friends over at Foothills here in downtown Winston-Salem, where I live. And I still remember when Jamie and his partners launched that operation, and I think it was back maybe around 2003 or four, somewhere in that range. But John, for me, and I'm not a connoisseur when it comes to beer and cocktails, but for me, prior to Foothills coming in the market, the only beer that I knew of was, Budweiser and Bud Light and Michelob and the sort of the big majors, I guess you could say. And then, Foothills came into our market, and e eventually we got Wise Man, and we got Incendiary, and we got Radar, and we've gotten a ton all throughout the region. You even have a number of people that are just home brewers, so they're just making beer at home. It seems like there's been like an explosion in the craft brewery space over the last 10 or 15 years. How is that starting to impact your business and maybe even some of your other colleagues in the space?
No, I think it's a great question, a great observation. I remember when Foothills opened being there that weekend. I was at Wake Forest at the time, and it was part of our conscious decision to go into cider was specifically because of that. I mean, at the time, if you rewind back to 2013, 2014 timeframe, there were already a couple of thousand, 3,000, 4,000 breweries that were operating in the country. There were permits in process of the TTB that were basically going to double that number. I don't know where it finally capped out, but your number of breweries, which we kind of fall in that cat. I know by permitting, we fall in a different category, but I think by patronage, we fall in a very similar complementary category, right? Being a cidery versus a brewery. And it probably got up into the 10,000s. And I think what you've seen over time, though, is yeah, you had this massive supply come on the market, and then everybody got into craft beer. And I think something that has particularly changed over the last 5, 6 years is that the excitement and the exclusivity of craft beer at a given time was only at the brewery. Didn't mean you couldn't find it anywhere, but you were going to find it at specialty bottle shops, at growler shops, at restaurants that specialized in it or something like that. But the real charm, the real explosiveness of the category was going to that brewery and catching the new release, right? Whether it's an IPA or some new stout or whatever kind of beer it was that they were doing. But if you fast forward to now, you can go to a chain account restaurant a Darden-owned restaurant, something like that, and you can find craft beer. So I think the novelty of only being able and the scarcity of only being able to find these at certain locations has worn off, that you now see craft beer available everywhere. So what does that mean and what does that do to a tap room? Well, it means there's less excitement, particularly if your tap room like ours, where we don't do food. I mean, we did potato chips and snacks, but like we never operated a place with a kitchen or offered food other than food trucks at our locations. So now if your options are instead of going to the brewery and potentially there's a food truck there and potentially they cancel or they don't show up or they weren't scheduled or it's taco truck again, well, now you can go pick any independent restaurant and they're going to have as good a lineup of craft beer as any place you could ever imagine. So I think that does steal away some of the traffic or volume if you are a brewery or a cidery only without a food option to keep the people. I do think the brew pub model, places that do have some sort of kitchen or actual food, is an important aspect. And I think it also is a unique time for that because there's a narrowing and spread between, well, historically, you'd probably say, well, oh, well, that food's more expensive. I'll go get fast food. And then just take that to the brewery or go to the brewery and get fast food. Well, food trucks are extraordinarily expensive anymore or anything off the menu there, but so is fast food restaurants. So now if you go to a brew pub or a good restaurant, I mean, the spread between fast food and actual food is not that high.
Yeah, no, I mean it does just feel like, and even as the space was getting built out, John, as I kept hearing this brewery opening and this tap room opening, I mean, just sort of, I mean, it felt like it was just one behind the other. I'm an economics guy, so I keep reading these headlines, and eventually I'm thinking, we're going to reach a saturation point here, where it's almost like musical chairs. Somebody's going to be left without a chair here. Where do you see the space being right now? I'm part of a group called Iron Horse Auction, and they auction off restaurant equipment and all types of stuff. And I will tell you, John, that I see a never-ending stream of brewery equipment available for auction right now through Iron Horse. Is that just
Absolutely.
symptomatic of everything that's happening all over North Carolina right now, or?
Well, and it's more than just North Carolina, you know. I mean, you can take a national holistic look at it and it's the same. I mean, there's Iron Horse, there's several other auction houses that, you know, if you're on the emailing list for these things, you're seeing an auction a week for some brewery somewhere. It might be in New York, it might be in Michigan, it might be in North Carolina, it might be in California, but any given week, there's a notification about another auction happening. And so I think as we got to the 10,000, whatever, 11,000 breweries, whatever it stabilized at and peaked at, you know, obviously we're walking that number backwards now. And we have, I think, a twofold problem. One, you could say, well, it was just overbuilt and there was oversupply. And I think that that is true, that we did oversupply. There were too many breweries built, too many cideries, breweries, whatever you want to call, but too many tap rooms and too much supply. Well, now we're trying to work out the oversupply and we're seeing the auctions and the out of business and everything that's happening on that side. But at the same time, I think now we have a increasing lack of demand overall too. And I think that is several different things, right? I mean, like I said, I think you've seen a change in your 21 to 30-year-old, early 30s consumer. They are not as much into alcohol as their predecessor generation. They are definitely not as much into alcohol or drinking as two generations ahead of that. So there is a health-centric shift, I think, that's happening in younger generations that we're certainly seeing. And I think it doesn't mean that they're not looking for some mechanism to relax, hang out, chill, but we're also seeing for the first time this past year, we've seen a lot more research and a lot more papers, but daily use of cannabis is higher than daily use of alcohol. Now, it doesn't mean the total dollar volume is outpaced yet, but the cannabis market now is about a $40 billion market, and just the ingestible side is about $7.2 billion. So that's gummies, drinks, whatever, is already the size of craft beer. And it's, I would say, in its infancy as an industry overall. So this is one aspect where it's like you're seeing this change in appetite for alcohol to some degree. If you talk to anybody that's in the taproom business, and and I'm sure there's an outlier, there's some anomaly, but in general, I would say most tap rooms are down. Definitely down versus, we're definitely down versus pre-pandemic numbers. But then even year over year, we're still seeing declines in overall traffic at our tap rooms. And it's just, I think there's a bunch of different things that play into it. You know, it's consumer changes and preference. I think just a general cultural change as people work from home and they don't go downtown anymore. They don't have to be downtown. They don't work downtown. You've really lost a lot of office culture. When you lose office culture, you start losing this after hours, after work culture of happy hours, of hanging out with colleagues. I think a lot of that has disappeared and changed as well. And people just hanging at home, right? I mean, they can order everything at home.
I definitely think the piece that you're identifying with young people and their shift in habits in terms of it's not that they're not still consuming vices, but they're just consuming a different vice and maybe not alcohol, but now that's THC or marijuana, however you want to frame it. Definitely makes sense that, you know, while we're seeing every brewery that shuts down, it seems like I see a new CBD shop open up. So that would certainly
Exactly.
make sense to me that's why we're seeing that trend. So if there's any young people out there that listens to my show, or you happen to be listening to WTOB this Sunday morning, we're going to need you to boost or beef up your alcohol consumption and reduce your
That's right.
THC consumption so that we
That
can keep Bull City and all these other great businesses in business. You know, John, you were sort of getting ready to go into this direction before I cut you off, but I do want to go back to the piece that you mentioned around demand, because I think when you shared with me about the change in habits of our younger consumers, that was really interesting information. But I'm also, you know, when I look at the economy in general, and everything across the board is much higher. I mean, food prices are higher. I think that's really weighing down on the American consumer. You look at credit card balances and they're just off the chart because consumers are having to finance everything on the credit card right now. You go in a restaurant, I know you're a big dining out guy. You know, if you and your significant other go out for dinner and you have one or two drinks, you might be at $200 plus, you know,
Oh,
in
yeah.
no time.
Yeah.
How much is all that pressure also starting to play into your business? Because, you know, if I really want a beer, I could still go to the gas station and
Absolutely.
get the old traditional 40 like we used to do back in
That's right. That's right.
the
Get the Old English and the Mickey's Malt, right? I mean, that's still cheap and you can bring it home and drink it, right? But no, I mean, I think you're spot on where it's not just this change in consumer habits and preferences at some level, but there's real meaningful, this is the ground level, real detail of what's changing when you see the shakeout of inflation. People talk about it, and they talk about it in the news, but you really want to see it, then go to small business that's focused on having a consumer come out. And if they can't afford to do it, it doesn't mean they don't want to drink or they don't want to do something. But if their choice is between going out and getting two drinks for $17, $18, or they can buy a six pack and sit at home and watch the movies, invite their friends over. Well, hell, man, a lot of people are going to get that six pack and hang at home. So inflation is obviously real. I mean, I think people see it, obviously their groceries, everything else, but it's kind of like craft beverage is this unspoken, you know, path and territory where, yeah, it's had a massive impact on our customer base that I don't really see the reversal of that because it's they can substitute the good with something from the grocery store or the bottle shop. So they don't have to go out. If it's too expensive to go out, then don't go out. Cook some food, get a steak and cook it at home. Buy a bottle of wine or cider or beer and have the buddies over and do that. And, you know, it's interesting. I've had the same conversation with some of my friends. And I said, you know, you're surprised by it, but look in our own life. Are we going out as, and obviously we're getting a little bit older, but are we going out as much as we used to go out? The answer is no. Whereas maybe we were going out grabbing a drink somewhere two, three times a week, potentially. Then I was like, when's the last time we went out? Or do you just come over to my house and drink my beer and cider? So, you know, it's like there's definitely a shift in a lot of different ways, but you cannot underplay the impact of extraordinarily high inflation for a long time, right? And at some point, even if the moderated the growth of inflation, you still have the impacts lingering and the impact of, well, that's the new pricing and that's the new pricing paradigm. So it's not going back and pricing your life accordingly.
Well, I think what you just said at the end there, I want to reiterate that for my audience because my audience has definitely heard me say this. Now that companies and the economy has digested these higher prices, prices are not going down. I don't care who you elected as president or who your congressman is or any of that. But once prices go higher, I mean, those prices tend to get fixed. Now, the rate of inflation, the rate of price growth has now come under control. We're not seeing that inflationary rate that we saw prior. But I think I agree with you, John. I think the prices that are in the system are the prices to stay. And not to get too wonky here, but to some degree, we don't want prices to start collapsing because that leads to deflation, which actually can be far more severe than inflation. And so I just think that it's probably going to continue to be a tough time for breweries and bars and restaurants to continue navigating this environment. And you're spot on, John. I've noticed, I've certainly got a little older too, so I don't go out as much either. But I'll just be honest with you. Part of the reason I don't go out as much is because of where prices are. I mean, you can go to the ABC store or you can go to Lowe's Foods and I mean, you can buy that food or you can buy that beverage and you can sit at home and enjoy your favorite movie or your favorite television show. And that's a good time for me. So speaking of, as we get ready to run out of time, I think COVID, I always say that COVID was such a defining moment. I think for the rest of my life, people will refer to historical events as pre-COVID and post-COVID. Like, I think it was just that much of a defining moment. I know for me, John, pre-COVID, man, I was out, 4 or 5 times a week. I can't say that even post-COVID that I ever got back to that same level of activity. It's almost as if I got a bit more comfortable with just enjoying my rent at home,
No, exactly.
and not going out as much. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, what are you seeing? And also, I know you talk to brewery owners all across North Carolina. Has there really been a true recovery from pre-COVID?
No, I definitely don't think there's a true recovery. Good for anybody who's gotten back to their pre-COVID numbers, but I think if you talk to a lot of places that were operating, I mean, 2017 to 2019, 2015 and 2019, and those were great times to operate a tap room, and there was a lot of traffic, and you could very consistently project who was showing up and what the numbers are going to look like on trivia night, what the numbers are going to look like on Saturday. And increasingly, you can still run all the same plays, you can still do trivia nights, you can do the live music, all the other stuff, but the consumer is not necessarily coming out. And so you spend a lot more time in activity and planning and trying to figure it out, but at diminished activity overall and diminished economics, right? Because also, like we were just talking about, everything's going up in price. So you're also working off compressed margins because everything's changed and everything has not changed going down in price. Every bit of it's gone up in price. So you got compressed margins, lower traffic. It's not a pretty picture in the beer and micro brewery and cidery industry, in my opinion. I just think a lot of people don't come on shows and talk about it or don't say it, but it's like, what good does it do to ignore it either? I mean, it's kind of the forgotten thing. It was interesting. My wife, who's in media, as you know, she was talking to one of her colleagues out in Las Vegas, and she was like, oh yeah, breweries are having a very tough time. And she was like, really? I had no idea. It's like, yeah, because I guess you're not in the space, but if you're in the space, you understand how oversupplied and under demand we currently are as an industry. And it's a tough position to be in because I don't know, like we said, if you've got these other shifts of things are more expensive, they got to make cost cutting decisions on their family pocketbook, just general cultural changes of not going out as much. Well, I don't know how you combat all that, which is why for us, like you and I were talking about offline, we're really focused on, luckily we have pretty good distribution across the state and into South Carolina, and really focusing a lot more of our effort on our production and distribution and our co-packing business, and less effort on trying to figure out what brings the consumer back, because that might be a 10 or 20 year, a generational change, that has to occur.
You know, John, I think there's some type of misnomer within our community that if you sell alcohol, you always make money. So if you're a cocktail bar, you're rolling in it. If you're making your own beer like you do and you're selling your own beer, I do think a lot of people in the community just assume that, John's making money hand over fist, the guy selling beer,
Right.
But no, I think this is a great conversation to help people understand. I mean, you're a small business and you're out there fighting and dealing with the same challenges and struggles that so many other small business owners talk about day to day. And I also think it's really important that we keep reminding people. I know COVID was, almost 5 years ago at this point, so it sounds a little crazy for me to keep trying to remind people about COVID, but the after effects of COVID has not fully left us. And there's no more support or resources coming out of the federal government or the state government or anything like that. And so a lot of these small and middle market business owners like John and so many others, they just got to figure it out at this point. I mean, this is their livelihood. This is where they've placed all their eggs in this basket. So, John, as we get ready to wrap up, man, I mean, as we're going into 2025, I know you're doing things to try to insulate your business. What's your advice to maybe not just brewery owners, but all small business owners in 2025?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is get skinny, really batten down the hatches and try to figure out what's extraneous and what can you cut, and then really dissecting your business and understanding where are the bright spots, where are the areas that seem like, well, look, here's the effort that we put on this and we're actually getting some sort of positive return. Lean into those. I mean, I know it sounds stupid, but lean into where you're making money and cut all the areas that you're not. But I think when times are different, or like in breweries, if you go back, pre-COVID, it can hide a lot of the warts when everything's happening that's positive, right? When the rising tide, all the
Yes.
ships are going up. But the reality is, when the consumer changes, when the oversupply is there, when the lack of demand's there, really dissect your business and try to figure out, well, what are the one or two things that we might do that are really good and are kind of bright spots within our business, whether you're in brew business or any other kind of small business? And you really have to take those and lean into them and put all your effort in that. And at the same time, what are extraneous activities? You cannot be everything to everybody. I mean, that's 101 business, but isn't always adhered to by entrepreneurs who, we're excitable people and we want to go in a lot of different directions. So it's like, well, maybe we should do this and do this and do this. And in some markets, and sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's how you land on the moonshot, the thing that becomes the best part about your business. But generally speaking, you got to just kind of put it all out, think about your business and evaluate where do we have bright spots, where do we have opportunity, where do we have the chance to fail, eliminate or mitigate as best possible your chances of failure, and focus on the areas where you can make some cash.
I think that's great advice. I've often shared with business owners, I think when all the trillions and trillions of dollars of government money came in response to COVID, I think it was helpful and it was supportive, but it also masked a lot of things. And it didn't allow for us to really see what was going on with the economy. And you had some what I describe as zombie type businesses walking around out here that were dead, really. But a lot of the government money was propping them up. And so now, I think a lot of those roosters are starting to come home to nest and we're going to have a little bit of shakeout within our economy. But I do think your advice is spot on. I mean, you just got to cut out the fat, get back to whatever your core focus is, whether that's making beer or making widgets or making cups or making whatever it
That's
is
right.
you make. And just get in there and sort of lock in on your business. So, John, I appreciate you locking in with me today. So my audience, make sure you go check out Bull City Cider. You can follow them on Facebook, Instagram. They've got a really great looking website. Their tap rooms look great. Make sure you go check them out and their products. Also, we didn't talk about it today, but John and his business partner, Ben, they also own Campus Gas right here in Winston-Salem. You all know how much I love a good hot dog, and some of the best hot dogs in Winston are right at Campus Gas, along with some great burgers and some other items that they have. So please support both of their small businesses. And as always, I encourage you to support local. Thank you to my audience for locking in. And as always, make sure you stay tuned to WTOB because every Sunday morning, That is where you can lock in with me there. But if you happen to miss me, hopefully you are subscribed to the podcast, and you can find that on Spotify, Pandora, wherever you like to get your favorite podcast. You can always lock in there. And until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.